over the, you know, over the bombing and of the trade.
Okay, this is September 21st, 2001. We're continuing the interview with Douglas Furstenow in Berkeley, California. This is tape number 24. We had been scheduled to have a little meeting yesterday afternoon here on the campus, and I started out on the bus a little afternoon, and the buses were all being rerouted by a campus demonstration, and I was sort of faint-hearted and decided not to try to get over here to the campus if there was a lot of commotion going on. So, but you got here all right, and brought back memories of 64.
Yes, I guess Berkeley's infamy started with the free speech movement of 1964. It turned out they had rules, and dumb rules, so no political tables, no solicitations, etc., on the campus, and somebody set up a couple of card tables soliciting membership in, you know, some kind of organization, which I now don't recall, but it immediately invoked this campus rule about no political activities should be on the campus, which started a demonstration. And the real activities for 1 week took place in Sproul Plaza, and I remember going down there, just absolutely packed with students, and there was a police car that had driven on, which was going to arrest somebody, and all the students surrounded the police car, and the person that the police had arrested was a student. I obviously must have been a student. And he was in the back seat of the car, and they surrounded the car. The car was up right near the Sproul steps. It was there all week, and as the week went by, the roof got flatter and flatter because everybody climbing up and standing on it, using it as a podium. And so this particular student lived in the car for the week. They handed things in and handed things out as necessary to stay alive. And I remember going down there and watching things for a bit. And the chancellor, whose name was Strong, he was a person who followed Seaborg as chancellor. Obviously, not a great leader under crisis. Never saw him at all. There was they had, I think, a committee of seven that sort of was a committee of senior people that sort of looked after what was going on the campus. I mean, an officially appointed committee. And my next door neighbor, Burton Moyer in physics, was one of those persons. And he, I remember him commenting, they thought that Strong must come to work. At that time, the chancellor's office was in Sproul Hall, must come to work in a tunnel. They never saw him outside. Anyway, one day they sent a young faculty member from our department, Alan Searcy, who was vice chancellor for research then. And they sent him out to speak to these thousands of students. And I remember I was down there watching, and he only talked a little bit, and they pulled a plug off the mic. So here he was busy talking, but nobody could hear him. which, but, you know, they sent the young man out. And finally, on the fifth day, I guess it was Friday, the police were called in, and they arrested, I think people were sitting in Sproul Hall, and I think they arrested 700 or 800 students. You know, they were packed in like sardines, about 500 policemen from Oakland, and I suppose state police came. Should have happened the first day, but, you know, let it go till Friday, and probably, probably by Saturday was a homecoming football game, if I recall. So they wanted things cleaned out before the parents came by. But anyway, after that, the faculty had many, many meetings. There were meetings I know up in Pauley Ballroom, meetings in the Wheeler Auditorium. You know, virtually all of the faculty showed up for these meetings. One was up at the Greek Theater, and at that time I recall Mario Savio come running or walking onto the stage and grabbing the microphone, and the police coming and picking him up, and about six of them carrying him out in a prone position. What was interesting, you look at pictures, everybody wore neckties and short hair. I'm speaking of the leadership of this. It's not what you see around campus today, but the students had neckties on and clean shirts and all this sort of thing. But they're meeting after meeting, and it was always interesting because there's a lot of eloquent speakers on the left and a lot of eloquent speakers on the right, often the same, roughly, you know, same people.
You mean the same?
At different meetings.
Yes,
but the,
yes.
Right. And but, you know, there were good people on each side. Of course, I think what you might call the speakers on the left, probably more of them than speakers on the right. But I remember one of the eloquent ones on the right was George Pimentel from chemistry.
What was his attitude?
Oh, in favor of well, I don't know quite how one would put it. I don't know that anybody's in favor of controlling speech, at least in keeping things under control as far as operations go. Mm-hmm. One could see, you know, this went on for months, up in the Hearst Mining Building, you never saw anything up in this end of the campus where the engineers and the sciences are. But if the helicopters were flying over, then you knew something was going on.
Hmm. But your classes continued?
Oh, yeah, all classes. Hmm. They went on as if nothing was happening, as far as I recall. But I often saw, learned what went on from the national news. Here I was right on the campus, but nothing significant going on in our end of the campus, but it was the national news for, you know, weeks, months. And I remember walking past Wheeler Auditorium and maybe about 7-8 people standing around, and a couple of news people with their big TV cameras just right in on the center, and then no one else. but saw that on say either CBS or NBC national news that evening. In other words, the news people were trying to make news out of it. I mean, I actually saw this happen. But after much, finally, very major meeting, the Senate passed in with a big majority what really amounts to free speech, under proper outlook on time, place, and manner. I remember were the three words, and that this should be allowed. By the way, years later, there was a International Geophysical Union meeting took place here in Berkeley. I know it's from all over the world. They met, I suppose, in different buildings and in the summer. And I went to a talk in Grinnell Plaza, and the speaker, and I suppose he'd been invited as a keynote speaker to this International Geophysical Union, was Adlai Stevenson. And he made the comment that when he was running for president, 1952, he gave a talk in Berkeley, and the people were on that grass on Oxford Street, where the grass comes up towards the campus entrance. The listeners were there, and he had to stand across the street on the sidewalk to give his talk due to these University of California non-political rules. And he said, and here I am today talking in the middle of the campus. But then, just going on ahead, again, during the Vietnam War, I remember when the Cambodia excursion took place, where
1970,
I think. Yeah, and 69, 70, yeah, this was this particular one would be spring of 70. The place was really bombed with tear gas bombs a lot, and I recall walking through Sproul Plaza and just tear gas dripping off those trees. And we then had one of our daughters was fourth, fifth grade down in Franklin School, almost down towards San Pablo Avenue, and the tear gas got in the school, clear down there. You know, Reagan was governor, and he really was gung-ho at controlling things. That was really bad business when maybe a mile and a half away the tear gas got into the school where these little kids were. And so, then were many, many demonstrations. By the way, I can recall walking out. I used to have to go to meetings regularly in Grinnell Hall, and I came out at about 4 o'clock one day, and this was on Sproul steps. The speaker was and I was really quite close. I hadn't anticipated this. Was Martin Luther King, and giving a, and at that time it was a anti-Vietnam War talk about, you know, that money should better be spent on people here in our country with problems and wasting them over there. And of course, it ends out he was right, but. But he, you know, talked about an hour without notes or anything, just gave a, you know, excellent, full of fervor talk.
Was there a big crowd?
Oh, big crowd. Oh, yeah, it was obviously a scheduled talk, not in the way of a seminar or anything, but it was because it was on the Sproul steps, but But I just by sort of, maybe I knew it was going to be there, but just kind of wandered by at the right moment to hear this this talk. By the way, in those days, I living here in Berkeley, you thought the whole world was coming apart, and whenever I used to go over to Salt Lake quite regularly, or to other places, and you know, it was a whole different world. You thought, you know, we were deluged with kind of anti-war, anti-this, anti-everything that you thought this was how the whole U.S. felt, and it was just a microcosm here that was was not at all like that one found, well, like I say, going over to Salt Lake City, which I did every month or two on a regular basis, but that eventually, I think probably in the 1970 era, early 1970 roughly, was really the last of that, then any demonstrations in the last decades at Berkeley have really not been much of anything. This one yesterday, I have no idea what went on there, but I pretty small percentage of the total people, and again, everything in Berkeley always has a lot of non-student participants. Also.
And you felt that it was students from a different, another section of the campus.
Oh, totally. Yeah, well, it always is. But I think what efforts there have been at demonstrations in the last 10 years have probably been planned and those behind it tried to work out what they want to accomplish, but I don't see the spontaneity that seemed to take place 35 years ago on it.
Let's see, I was just looking here, in 1964 you were chairman of the College of Engineering Undergraduate Study Committee, and you were vice chairman of the Department of Material Science and Mineral Engineering at that time. You didn't go on the campus committee on budget and interdepartmental relations until 66, but you were on some very significant committees at that
time. I can tell you a little bit about the committees. One of the, maybe the very first committee I became a member of was called the Committee on Prizes, that turned out to be...
That was a statewide university.
Well,
committee.
It was campus, it was also statewide, but let me back up. Somehow, for a while, there was a statewide academic assembly, I think it was called, and I was made a member of that, and I was really, that was early on here, and I found that really quite interesting. Maybe that was a couple of years, met maybe in Berkeley. I remember going over to Davis, and another time we met at UC Santa Barbara, and it gave one a nice opportunity to meet different faculty. Mike Heyman, who became chancellor, was then on that committee, or that assembly group. He was in law and civic planning, and Professor Washburn from anthropology, maybe Kretsch from psychology. Now there's quite a wide variety. Well, Heyman is not older than I am, but all the rest were far more senior than I. But it gave a nice introduction to different people. But then maybe the first committee I think I did get on was the undergraduate study committee in the College of Engineering. And having worked in industry, especially Union Carbide, which had a lot of committees, I thought, well, you know, you serve on committees, you're really doing something big and important. And it took me a little while to realize that serving on a committee at Berkeley, at least in my opinion, isn't a big thing in your career. And but the undergraduate study committee approved courses, looked to make sure that people met graduation requirements, things like that. Maybe there were petitions from students. This dates back 40 years, but petitions from students. You know, students had to have not only a grade point average of 2.0 to graduate, that's a C average, but they also had to have the number of units and the total number of grade points. In other words, the total units times two. And if I remember once in a while somebody was short a unit or two, and they may have to come back, take another course, and make sure they got a B out of it to get those to make that exact 2.00. So petitions on these would be handled. Then I think I ended up being the chairman of that for a couple of years. But it was. But like I said, at first I thought, oh, this is, you know, a really big time thing here in the college committee. But as I say, I began to realize that committees aren't necessarily the main item. And so the committees I served on were very important ones, and I consider that the main, I mean, really the main committees, and very, very valuable in many ways. But it got on the prize committee, which sort of sets policy and that sort of thing on prizes. We didn't read the poems or essays or and do the judgment, but I don't know, dozens of prizes in art and literature and poetry and philosophy and things like that on the campus, and so I guess we set policy and made sure that there were people who would do the judging and so on. But anyway, I served on that several years, and actually chairman a couple of years, and that one I found very interesting. I got to know very well Andrew Imbrie, for example, who's a composer, faculty member in music, and I used to sit at lunch with him every now and then, and I saw a big thing in the Chronicle only last week about his 80th birthday, and you know, at the opera, he had an opera about gold mining days called Angle of Repose, music being quite far out modern, but there it was in the prize committee. I got to know him very well. Then Joe Kerman, who is lectured and written, musicologist, written many books and great lectures on music, got to know him there. The first year I was on the committee, the chairman was Tom Parkinson, and in English. And we met in his office, because the committee was only five people, maybe six at most. It was during that time that he was meeting in his office with two of his grad students and a deranged former student that lived in Oakland, Piedmont, or somewhere like that, came in with a shotgun and killed one or two of the grad students and got him in the side of his head, face, and I often shuddered that we could have been meeting there. You would have read about that when it happened, but I only remember it because we had been meeting for our meetings in his office. And then the previous chairman of that committee was an engineer, Werner Goldsmith, again took over running the committee for the rest of that year. Anyway, I was on that maybe a total of 4 years, and also chaired it at least 2 years. But the beauty of that is it's a way of meeting other, interacting with people that an engineer might normally not do. Then, of course, the committee that everybody on the Berkeley faculty always knows about and seems to they think of it in terms of a cloud hanging over their head. It's called the Budget Committee. And I was on sabbatical and I got a letter asking me if I would be willing to serve on this committee. They said, well, this is very difficult, time-consuming, so they would ask ahead of time if somebody would be willing to do that.
And see, you were on it from 66 to 69.
Yeah, 3 years.
So you were on your, was that one of your German sabbaticals?
No, we were in London.
London.
At the time. I can tell you a little bit about that
right.
Another time. Yeah, I got this letter while in London, and you know, I wasn't very old then, either. So I began, when I got back in the summer, and we may have had an occasional meeting in the summer, which was more or less just to take care of mopping up stuff, because the main activities really get going in the fall and winter. But the chairman was somebody who I've gotten to know much better in the years since. It was a history professor named Delmer Brown. And I guess you people did an oral history of him about a year ago.
Yes.
And it turns out we've really become quite good friends, because about 10 years ago he married a good friend of my wife, the friend being much older than us, but his first wife had died, and he married Margaret, but anyway, I still to this day remember the first presentation I made to the committee, which was somebody getting promoted, and I had written and was making a presentation that this individual shows great promise and therefore deserves promotion to tenure. And Delmer Brown said, young man, we appoint on promise and we promote on performance. Boy, I never, you can tell I haven't forgotten that. By the way, Delmer Brown is now about 92, and 1 year, he doesn't look any different than he did in 1966, and even a year ago had another book published. Amazing how he...
Remarkable, isn't it?
Isn't it something? Mm-hmm. When you look at him and talk to him, you think, wow, he's 70-ish, but he's gotten to be 91, 92, and still still got fire and so on. Mm-hmm. Anyway, you know, this committee you know, handles all appointments, promotion, and interdepartmental relations and so on. And I gather in more recent years, interdepartmental allocation of resources is more effort is spent on that than probably was, you know, 35 years ago, because mm-hmm. resources getting tighter. Obviously, by resources, I mean, you know, academic slots and this sort of thing. I think all are now in the allocation of resources is taken up by the budget committee. But I kept track of the time I spent there. It was something like 35 hours a week in the fall and early winter that I spent down in that office. And I did not want to give up mornings. I mean, you know, we had our meetings in, you know, once a week or twice a week in the busy time of the year in the morning, but I'd go down and work in the afternoon or maybe Saturdays, things like that. And
you were carrying a teaching load in addition.
Oh yeah, that was just, everything else was the same.
Hmm. That's a huge amount of time.
Yeah, it really was. And this is just this is the time I put on it because mm-hmm. you you know, really makes judgments on the performance of people and each committee member may serve in a or handle a different area. You know, for example, I naturally handle cases from engineering, but the first year, which was really the heavy one, was too heavy. It was in college, and environmental design was under I had to take care of, and plus I think geology and maybe chemical engineering. It was the largest number of cases came through me and my predecessor. Then they added another person to the budget committee, and just to bring those loads a little more evenly. But you know, there'd be somebody always from.
Just a minute.
Okay. So somebody maybe from English, you know, somebody, you know, there'd always be people in humanities, maybe, you know, one person at least from the sciences, either physics or chemistry, always, you know, one from engineering, maybe, of course, somebody related to the biology. In other words, to cover the faculty spectrum. I think even the first year I was handling kind of decorative art, that's not quite the title of it, but this was I'll get it later, which is a department, they all fought each other till they just were abandoned finally. Let them all retire and they just couldn't agree on what way, there might have been people who been involved with weaving or something, and then somebody would propose, well, they get into modern kind of activities, and of course the old ones went, they just fought themselves. There's always a, mm-hmm. you can see a problem. And so I had to do this, but what I found was I could make the judgments on anybody in any field to realizing, hey, are they doing a good job or are they not? You don't have to be an expert to understand if somebody maybe the language is that person really doing research or not? And I spoke up on it, on my opinion. And I found the same to be true during all my years there with Homestake, that I could make a judgment about somebody being a mine manager if they were doing the, what I would call innovative job as a mine manager, or just kind of a pedestrian employee, and you don't have to know how to do that itself, but you can, at least in my opinion, want to make those judgments. No, they don't have to abstain.
How did you make these judgments in the case of a faculty member if you didn't know the person?
Well, for example, somebody in the language area, it said the whole thing came through that, well, he's done the written 16 unpublished volumes of research on what he's done, on but none of it's been published. And I said, well, it's not research till it is published.
Mm-hmm.
So we can't give him credit for doing something like this, and which I firmly believe. If it wasn't of the kind of quality that could, and of use for in his field, it really isn't the kind of effort that he ought to be granted a merit promotion or something on. And that was one case that I can recall.
How did you evaluate the teaching?
Everybody's a good teacher. Every person's a great teacher. It's kind of funny. I recall in one area, professional area, not engineering, he's not very good in the classroom, but he's excellent in seminars.
Mm.
I don't know how many times you'd read it was excellent, and X is excellent in seminars. Okay, so everybody's a great teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Today, see, that, and by the way, there were none of these formal evaluations that we talked about already. Today, you pass these out to students, I think the raw data has to go forward on promotion cases and things like that, not just summaries. But
there were no student evaluations in those days.
That, I think the student evaluation probably got started as a result of some all of the demonstration things about improving teaching, improving this and that with interaction with students.
Mm-hmm. Was there any pressure to put a student on the budget committee?
Well, that's impossible.
Uh-huh.
Absolutely impossible. For example, one person who I when you're meeting with about seven people, it's many hours a day, a week, and let's say one's down there working over, meeting the cases in one's area. There'll be the one or two others might be there, and as over the months you talk to them quite a bit, and just in general. There's one person, biology, even for the simplest merit case, he wrote three pages, when three or four sentences, I'm speaking of the summary, would have been adequate. And after 1 year, he said he was going to resign from it. He just couldn't do it. And can see it. I mean, there was no reason to write an essay on just a merit increase, but he was that intense about it. And this same person who, as I said, I got to know quite well, he retired, you know, when he hit retirement, which is now quite a while ago, and had a heart attack and died June 20th. If he'd lived 10 more days, his wife wouldn't have got any of the insurance, you know, that comes from the faculty insurance, which is term, you know, which I don't know. Probably then it may have been two or three times, I think, annual income, and eventually got to up to four. So that was really, in my opinion, something that, but it may show one a little bit about the intensity of this particular person. Mm-hmm. But anyway, when he stepped down, all of a sudden there were several people put forward by the committee and committees, and one person was a very active in all sorts of committees on the campus, but it was 10 years at the lowest step of the professorship. And whoever's the chairman, you know, went immediately to the chairman of the committee and committees and said, hey, you can't put such a person on the budget committee. You know, here's somebody who has not moved ahead. Can, you know, that person can't judge other people. So you need people with the capability of judging people in their field. And I remember the chairman of the committee saying that one member, he noticed, always agreed with whatever his dean recommended. And so the chairman, you know, I don't remember, he talked to the committee or he just mentioned it to me and somebody else there, but he said, you know, this person isn't really of any, probably not to the whole committee, isn't of really any value to the budget committee, because all he's doing is repeating what his dean is suggesting. And that person, you know, was not on the committee the next year. And I know I myself didn't agree with what Maslach often wrote, and Maslach then being the dean, to be precise. Because, you know, I was there representing, well, I could see the picture in relation to the rest of the campus, whereas a dean in a college only sees it within within the college. So, you know, I express things myself. Anyway, as I said, I did this for the 3 years, and I knew everything about everybody, all about appointments, X, Y, and Z, people I never met, but I still to this day can remember lots of details about a lot of people. Or I meet somebody sometime and I remember when they got appointed. But there again was a nice way of really good interaction with other people. And one person that I found very interesting was a very famous person in sociology named Leo Lowenthal. And Lowenthal became a member of the committee when he retired, which is kind of an unusual time. And And it turns out this may have been, we probably were there together for 2 years, and here he was, professor of sociology, but a very good ally for cases in the professional schools. You know, in the humanities, sciences, you know, it's teaching, research, service is what promotions and so on are based on. But in professional schools, it can also be professional competence. In other words, an architect is not going to be writing papers on, well, he might write some, but the professional competence would be the buildings he designed, or landscape architecture could be lighting or something. That, and in engineering could also have, of course, professional competence. And so I found Lowenthal was a very good person on the professional competence part of an ally, let's say, on this. But Lowenthal was said he was the head of what was called the Frankfurt School of Economics or something like that. In the 1933, when Hitler got elected, he said he took his whole school and they moved out. And I think he said first went to Switzerland, and he was at Columbia for a while. Eventually, he was here at Berkeley for decades. I think there's a very detailed, maybe, oral history of him. It may be in German, because the Germans may have done it. But he was a, you know, a very great person, and I think died not very many years ago, 90 something. And but even a couple times later, he called me up, and we went over and had lunch maybe at the Durant Hotel. I think a couple of times after that. I've had that kind of interaction,
and he was on the committee after he had retired.
For 5 years. He served longer than anybody ever served on that committee, and when I learned that, you know, he was going to be appointed, I said, well, you know, it's me, seem like the right thing to do to appoint somebody who's retired, because you're looking at the future. But it turns out he was a superb choice. Well, then, all during my time, Jack Rowley, professor of English, was on the committee, and he became the chairman last year. And of that. And Rowley, after that, was vice chancellor for academic affairs for several years. Rowley was, you know, I got to know quite a while. And anyway, Rowley told me that, this is a handful of years ago, that one time he was talking with Lowenthal, and he said, well, you know, you served 5 years on that committee. Who'd you think? What's your opinion? Who were the best committee members you worked with? And he said Dave Templeton, who was a chemistry professor, became dean there, quite a bit older than I am, but we overlapped a bit. And yours truly, which
real compliment.
That's not in writing anywhere, but as I told you, I felt that I was able to make judgments on all sorts of different things,
and that, of course, is. Key committee.
It is the key. But I know how people have, at least used to, and I suppose still do, always, you know, feared the budget committee. But I came away saying, hey, you know, 80% or 90% of your welfare, I'm speaking of one's welfare on this campus, is self-determined. In other words, it's the performance of the individual faculty member that determines his welfare, not the budget committee. And whereas, you know, I'd always heard about, you know, this sort of black cloud hanging over everybody in the budget committee, but as I see it, a faculty member at Berkeley is on his own personal ladder. It's not like in Europe or maybe other institutions in this country where there's kind of a hierarchy. Here, the way I read it, one competes only against himself. I am not competing against any other professor in the department. And so how well I do in this system is determined by my own productivity. And as I told you, I put that, you know, always was dedicated to what teaching I did, but, you know, the research counts very heavily, and as I think it should, and you hear about places like this, Publish or Perish. I just happen to be a firm believer in that, you know, published a lot of papers and still am. And I think, you know, all of that determines one's mm-hmm. welfare and not the budget committee. Department chairmen have a, you know, certain influence depending on whether they, you know, aggressively push somebody ahead. But way back before I got on the budget committee, I heard Maslach used to say that he was very proud of that all cases that he put forward as dean were approved by the budget committee. Well, after I'd been there, you know, a good part of the year, I talked to Maslach and said, hey, you know, the problem is you're not putting enough cases forward. You ought to put more so that you get some turned down, because what the budget committee is comparing between schools, colleges, departments in a way, and you're only looking at it inside the college. So push more people forward. Mm-hmm. And if some get turned down, that's fine. But if you're turning none down, you're not pushing enough. So anyway, I urged several times to, you know, push more people mm-hmm. on through.
I had a note here to ask about, and I don't know if this is the time to bring it in, but we wanted to talk about how many years it takes to get a PhD. Now,
hey, I'll tell you, let's come back to that one in a second.
And also but, the advisory board to LBL.
Maybe we can just do a little more on these committees, because I didn't serve on a lot of them.
You were on a lot of committees.
Yeah, but I'll just tell you a little bit about a couple others.
Okay.
An important committee at Berkeley is is what's called a committee on committees.
Yes.
And which is, you're elected to it. Okay, so I agreed to let my name be put forward. I think you got to get a half a dozen seconders, and they usually go around at a variety of departments and so on, and then there's this election. And so the first time I didn't get elected, but I was the first runner-up, I guess. Let's say there might be 8-10 names, and maybe there's 4 or 5 new people or 6 new people every year get on the committee and committees. Anyway, somebody went on sabbatical, so they said, well, now you were the runner-up, so you now go on the committee and committee. So that's how I first got on, whatever year that was.
It was, well, you were on twice. You were on 1970 to 1972.
Okay.
And 85 to 87.
Okay, so the first time was a result of what I'm just talking about. So mm-hmm. I served 2 years in that. So this is a committee that appoints, you have a handful of 3-4 committees, I guess, that one looks for membership of. So it turns out in the spring, you know, that might be committee on courses, committee on research. I just pull these out of the air. You bring up names that the committee discusses, and when they agree that these names might be the ones to do, then you get on the phone and try to convince the professor that would they be willing to serve on the committee. That's the time where it gets kind of busy.
You were also chairman of the department at the same time.
Was that? Oh, I would have been, right?
Mm-hmm. So you
anyway,
had a little bit of
right.
leverage there.
So anyway, that committee has that function. It also has another function that often the chancellor office may have well, there are review committees and things like this, or committees to search for a dean, or committees to search for, and they want a panel of names. And let's say they want 5 people to be a panel to review something. Well, then you give them 10 names, and I remember one time. It was just kind of a Mickey Mouse panel to review somebody's animal farm of some sort in psychology, and it kind of amazed me that the big names that people would throw in that ought to be put on this panel. And I remember saying, hey, look, all we're talking about is a monkey farm. You don't want to waste X, Y, or Z for this sort of thing. You know, and I remember there's some schools around here that, you know, have 10 faculty members, but that means they then have a dean.
Mm-hmm.
And a search, you know, come up with a panel for the search for a new dean. And again, you know, all the people start throwing out big names. And I remember one time saying, hey, look, you know, this, we're talking about a dean of a faculty of 7, 8, 9 people. Here you have one of the major departments in the campus, electrical engineering, with 75 people, and the chairman is appointed by the dean.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and now, which is the case, you see. So I several times would just, you know, try to keep people in their perspective of relative importance, but this is the role of the committee on committees, and I remember the chairman of the committee handles the budget committee. You know, in other words, makes the does the work of, well, we talk about who might be people. That person then was the one who would, I think that was the only committee that the chairman, of course, had to look after. I mean, then, as you said, 85, I guess, I stood for election again, and that one, at that time, Tien was on the committee and committees, and it was kind of interesting times because he was made vice chancellor for research, and there often is no vice chancellor of research at Berkeley. It's usually handled by the graduate dean. Searcy was that for maybe the first one when I was here, and then there was another one, then there was none. Then they made Tien the vice chancellor for research, and at that time, it came out in the papers that there was being a little bit of a retraction on admission of Asian students, Asian heritage. And two judges got involved with it, and Tien, of course, being Chinese, and I think that was kind of the beginning of catapulting him to the, into the administration. But at that time, there were 3-4 of us who were engineers, which included somebody from chemical engineering on the committee. It's good to have them, because that already determines membership on some of the others. Then the other committee that I got involved with a few years later was the research committee. I served on that several years and chaired it for at least 2 or more years.
Which one was this? The
Committee on Research. It'd be after
I'm looking
that.
For it here.
Tien then was the vice chancellor for research here for at least one of the years. And one of the main activities that the first year I was chairman of the committee.
And here we are, 1984 to 86, you were chairman.
Okay, a research committee.
Berkeley Campus Committee on Research.
Right, okay. So anyway, when I was chairman of that, what was the state really got heavily involved in enforcing a conflict of interest. And I think it was San Diego and UCLA just kind of whitewashed the rule, and they really got tough about it. And so we had to review, there was a committee set up to review every proposal that might have conflict of interest with the principal investigator. So I spent a lot of time on that. As chairman, with this other committee where we had to sit and make a judgment and sometimes call in the professor to explain his role. And it was really way too small. I mean, if you own stock, I remember somebody had Exxon stock. Well, how many shares of Exxon would you have to have any influence if Exxon gave a research grant, or somebody that whose oral history you did had a lot of research projects from PG&E, and of course he owns some PG&E stock, but you would have no influence on that. But I think it got as low as, like, if you collected $100 on the seminar, you had to, from that company, you had to include that. And this was, say, you know, in the economics of that day, but still too small. We had to go through all of this, and it wasn't related, you know, to grants from NSF or something, but it is if a company gave one a grant. Now, there's a piece of research I wanted to do on milling gold ores, and I still would love to do that. And Congress said, well, send me a proposal. Well, you know, I never did it because I knew how could, even though in my personal opinion, this would have been just as ethical as, because I wanted to study the engineering principles involved with this idea. But it'd be pretty hard to convince anybody that a board member of Homestake had this grant from Homestake without any conflict of interest, so I just decided I never submitted the proposal, but that was a big role. Another thing we did during this time was you know, what about research funding, and so often people thought of research equipment in terms of technical people, but we ruled that people in humanities could buy computers, and so they or might be a group of two or three, yes, remember this is quite a while ago, jointly the department buy a computer for word processing for, you know, a group of two or three people. That all got started then. Just